very soft, very soft, very. Can you hear me? Is that on the? Yeah, you can hear me, but is it on the? Okay. Yeah, but when I tap it, I hear it, but when I talk, I. Let me see if we get interference here. Okay. That should give interference, but it is not. Okay, I hope that this sound is good. It's difficult to hear it. Before we start today, welcome everybody, by the way, everybody. Before we start today, I want to say something about the project because I get a number of questions about that. I get a number of questions about referencing and what I call scientific sources or scientific papers. You have to write about heartbleed. That's the main thing, that's the main topic. But in order to say something about heartbleed, you should be able to say something about the protocol behind it, so SSL, TLS. You have to say something about the heartbeat part of that. So you have to give some background information. And if you use RFCs or web pages or whatever to reference for or books for references to that, that's okay, no worries. If you want to go and discuss security issues related to heartbleed and how heartbleed exactly functions, yeah, then going to a website is not the best the best option. The sources in scientific papers are checked. If you send in a scientific paper, there is a colleague, an expert in the field that will review your paper, and that means that there will be more always, there will be two or three. That means that the content of a scientific paper, of an academic paper, has been checked and has been found valid. If I have a blog, I can put on that whatever I want. If I have a newspaper, if I write a newspaper or whatever, I can write down whatever I want. Could be correct. I'm not saying that it's wrong, but there is nobody else that can vouch for that. So you can use that kind of information also, but use it as... use it with the assurance level that it should have. There is information. They are saying this, but we confirm that with another source, or maybe we can't confirm it. But then this is the opinion of that particular one person. Yeah, so use it in the correct way. Clear? Okay, good. Let's go to access control. That's the topic of today. Today there will be two chapters, chapter 4 on access control, and then a bit more specific on a number of models in chapter 13. But first, general access control. I'll follow again the structure of the book. I will not do all of the topics, by the way. Start very general. Authentication and authorization. Those are two different terms. Often confused if you're not really know what you're talking about, but these are really two different concepts. Authentication, we discussed that before. Authentication and identification, when we're talking about passwords and biometrics, etc., etc., that was to give a person access to a system. Once a person has access to a system, there is authorization that needs to determine if the user has right to access a particular file or whatever on that system. Access control implements a security policy that specifies who or what, so it could also be a process, doesn't need to be a person, who or what can have access to specific system resources and the type of access that is permitted. Yeah, so now I'm really looking at, okay, I got access to this computer, I can log on to some disk with general information that everybody can access to, but the fact that I can or cannot open a file, that depends on my role or my credentials. So that's authorization. Authentication is getting access to the system. Authorization is granting permission to particular resource. Audit is also very important in this concept, because what we want to make sure is that we can later on see who got access to what documents and if the policies are followed. Yeah, simple procedures. So the first step of a user is, it's hard to read, is the authentication. Once they have authentication and they want access to a particular document, then the authorization steps in place and that full process is audited. There is a number of different access control policies, different names: discretionary access control, mandatory, role-based, and attribute-based access control. The first, discretionary access control, we'll talk about that more in detail right after, controls access based on the identity of a person and the access rules stating what is allowed and what not. Yeah? So that's discretionary access control. Mandatory access control, there we have so-called security labels. Security labels of objects, security clearances of users, and then we'll see if there is a match, so there are rules how that can match and what a person can do. Then the third one is role-based access control. This one will actually be in the second half of the talk. We'll concentrate on the other three. Role-based access control is rather similar to discretionary access control, except this one is based on the identity of a user, and this one is based on the role that the user has in a specific organization. So in my role as teacher, I have specific rights. Yeah, and those rights will be very similar to any other teacher. So why have that set of rules for me and then copy it for another person as would have been done here? Yeah, you can have a bit more granularity here. I can access this file and another teacher can access this file, but anyway. So that's role-based access control. And then attribute access control is not so much based on a role, but on properties that we add to a particular person, or a particular role could also be. And so there are four different kinds of access control. I'm going the wrong way. So first, some terminology. Let's start with that. We'll talk about a subject, an object, and what's the third one, actually? A subject, an object, and a... And access rights, of course. Yeah, the subject, that is an entity that can access an object. I haven't even defined an object yet, but you can see it as a person or a process running on a system. And actually, there are three classes of subjects, and the owner, that's the one who created the object. The group, that is a set of subjects that can access the object in one way or another. And the world is, well, everything else. Maybe that could be read access also, but yeah, the further I go down, the least access rights will be given. Yeah, the owner has the most access right, and then it's getting less and less. Then an object, that's a source to which the access is controlled. For simplicity, a subject is a person and an object is a file. If you think about it, that will clarify most things. And then the access rights. And the access rights actually give me rules about how subjects can access objects, who can which user can access what kind of file, and how. Can a person read a file? Can he execute it or delete it? Or so there can be a variety there also. So let's start with discretionary access control to make it a bit more tangible. In discretionary access control, we use a so-called access matrix. An access matrix, it's a two-dimensional matrix. It has two axes. On the one axis, there are subjects. On the other axis, there are objects. And then inside that matrix, I will tell you what kind of access rights a specific person, a specific subject, has to a specific object. So as an example, we have subjects here, three users. We have four objects, four files. And if we look at user B and file 2, user B actually is the owner of the of file 2, and he has read and write access to that file. And for the same file 2, user C actually has only read access, so he can read the file. User A has no access to that file. So that's a general concept of an access control matrix. Obviously, just three users and four files here, in practice, that will be a lot of a huge matrix, a lot of users, a lot of objects. But many of these entries in such an access matrix will be empty. So it will be a very sparse matrix. Yeah, not in this small example, but in practice it will be. So usually sparse, as I said. We can decompose now this matrix in two ways. We can decompose it by row or by column. If we decompose it by column, we get so-called access control list. Remember, the columns are related to objects. Yeah. So an access control list shows per object what the rights of the users are. Yeah, that could be some default entry for a user, because there are many empty spots in this access control matrix. There could be a default policy for users that are not explicitly mentioned. Maybe it's no access, maybe it's just read access or whatever. So that's for, let's say, the world group user. So here, based on the previous access control matrix, I think for this file we looked at that. User B was the owner and had read and write access, and there is another user C who has read access only, and then it ends. Yeah, so this represents the second column of the matrix we had on the previous slide, and we can do this for all users. So per file, we see now who has access and what kind of access. But I can't see what a particular user can do. So it's not easy to determine what a user, what a subject is allowed to do. Yeah, let's see user 2, user B. Oh, yes, read access here, and oh, here is the owner, and here's... Yeah, but I have to go over this full list of access control, this full set of access control lists to find that out. But I can decompose the access control matrix also by column. By row. So by column gave me the access control list. If I do it by row, it gives me the what is called capability tickets, and it says something about what a particular subject can do. So user B has read access to one to the first file, he owns the second file, he has write access to the third file and read access to the last file. Yeah, so now I quickly can see what the access control is of a particular person. But again, I have the problem, I can't turn it around. Who has access to file 2? I have to search again over all these. Apparently, capability tickets have a higher risk, a higher security risk. Not sure why it's higher, I couldn't really figure it out. But what we need to assure that a user, let's say here user A, he cannot quickly add a new pointer to file 2, for example, with read and write access. Yeah, so that should be some kind of control that these capability tickets are genuine. There's no change in the ticket there. Yeah, so we have the matrix, which is sparse, so it will take up a lot of space if I'll put it as a matrix in some kind of system. But I can decompose it row-wise or column-wise, so I get access control list or I get capability tickets. But all of these have their own disadvantages, of course, and advantages, of course. Yeah, we said that. Here's an alternative that actually I can make a table that gives me all the access rights. So this is again from the same matrix. All the entries are in there. Let's see, we had user B had read access to file 1, and he was the owner of file 2, but he also had read and write access to file 2, and here user C had also read access to file 2. We discussed these before. Yeah, but here we have all the information that was also in the access control matrix in a table. And if I sort that table by subject, I can easily see what a particular user is allowed to do. Yeah, just take that part. If I would sort it according to object, I could easily find find the equivalent of the access control list. Yeah, so if I have a table that I can sort either by subject or by object, I have all the information there. Using a relational database could give me an easy implementation of that. There's another access control model which actually extends the set of objects. So an object is not necessarily just a file. An object could be a subject also. Could be memory location or regions, for example, files. Could be processes. Could be complete devices, like disks. And then the access matrix would look a bit like this. We have the subjects again as the rows, and then we have the objects again as the columns. But now the objects are split into various types. And then a triple like this, S alpha X, means that a subject X, S, wants to access an object X using access right alpha. Yeah, so for example, subject S1 wants to read once I've read access to file F1. And then we can check if indeed this access right is in this matrix. So S1 and F1, there is read access there. Okay, so that would be allowed. If this would be S1 write file 1, you can see S1, F1, he has read access, he doesn't have write access. That would not be allowed. So once there is a request, we can check it with the matrix. There is a star here, which is in these two places, which is a copy flag. Somebody can copy that access control to another person. So there are some ways of changing the content. We can transfer rights. So if the person transferring the right has the copyright, this star, then he can transfer. This could be a read star, so he can give read or read star access to somebody else. He can't give write access to somebody else, but only read or read star. He can delete an object or an access write from a person to a particular object. There are all kinds of rules. These are just examples. You can add more rules if you want. Yeah, so we have the initial access right, but people are working on documents. They are reading it. They are writing it. So, and here the access rights can actually be also changed. Yeah, so that's the more or less in a nutshell the discretionary access control mechanism in a particular model for that. In the book, you will also see that it will be applied to Unix file access control. I will not cover that. You can find that in the book. I will continue with role-based access control. So, as said before, it's very similar to discretionary access control, but in discretionary access control, it's based on the identity of a person, on a single user. But here we will assume that within an organization, there might be a number of people which have the same role, same kind of role, and which will have then very similar access rights. And a user can have multiple roles. That's possible. There's no reason to restrict that. But also a role will, in general, have multiple users acting on that role. Yeah, if not, then actually this would not make any sense. Yeah, so if you have some access rights for role R1, then it applies to the number of users right away. And the matrix we just saw actually is the same as this one, except that instead of talking about subjects, I talk about roles here. And instead of having subjects as part of the objects, I have roles as part of the objects. So all that stays the same. Almost the same, similar. RBAC also leads to an effective implementation of least privilege, meaning that a role should have the least, the minimal set of access rights needed for that role. I can't do that with discretionary access control. I'm just one subject. If I log on, I have all the rights that subject has, even if I need less access control less rights for that particular task that I'm doing. Here, if I have different roles, for example here, user 3 has two different roles. Yeah, if he needs to do something related to this role, he will log on using this particular role, and he will then get access right to exactly needed for that task. If he then later logs on with another role, he will get different access rights. Could be much more than he needed to have right here, or less, depends. Yeah, so we can easily make sure that when I have a particular task to do in a particular role, I will get the access rights needed for that, not more. As a security measure, obviously. There are different flavors of RBAC. There is the base model, but then we can start extending that using hierarchies or constraints. I will go into that a bit further. So we can, once we have the base model, we can either add hierarchies to that, or we can add constraints to that. So we'll get RBAC 1 and RBAC 2 from that. But actually, we could also add the both, and then we get something that is RBAC 3, the consolidated model. Let me see. So here we have that. So RBAC 0 has the let's say the minimal functionality, and then we increase the functionality by adding these types. So here's the base model. We have a user, and the user can take on a number of roles, and roles are given to a number of users, can be given to a number of users. Within a session, a user just takes one role, and then based on that, there will be permissions in the access control matrix that shows how I can operate on particular objects. So that's the basic. That's nothing more or less than what I just discussed. But let's see what happens if we add hierarchies. Typically, a higher hierarchy will give you more responsibility. If you are higher up in the organization, you will get more responsibilities, and you will have a greater authority to particular resources. Accessing these resources. So a subordinate job may have a subset only of the access rights that the superior job function has. Meaning that if there is an engineer that is working as my subordinate, he might have a number of access rights. I will have the same access rights as he has, plus some additional ones. Yeah, so that's the internet. So here we have a particular organization. We have the director at the end, and they are running a number of projects. So there is a project lead here and a project lead there. And that project lead has then a number of subordinates who then both control an engineer, etc., etc. The access control rights that this engineer has, these two will have the same access control rights added with some specific access control rights needed for their jobs. Yeah, so if this particular one has these access rights, then the product engineer will add some more, and the quality engineer will add some more. There can be some overlap between the added access rights, but not needed. And then actually the project lead will then have all these access rights that these three have, plus maybe some more. This person might have completely different access rights. This role could have completely different access rights. This could be the same person, by the way. This is a role. Yeah, it could be the same person having these two roles. But if that person is in this particular role, he can access a number of objects with particular access rights. Once he is in this role, he might not have access to those objects at all. So particularly project files that belong to this project, you can see when he is in this role, once he moves over to this role, he might not have access to them anymore. Yeah, even though it's the same person. And the minimal set of access rights that is needed to execute this particular role, he will get those. But that does not include files that are in this particular project. So that's when we add hierarchies. We can also add constraints, and here are a number of constraints. Mutual exclusive roles, cardinality, prerequisite roles. The user can be assigned only a single role in a set of roles. Yeah. You could have mutually exclusive permissions when we switch between roles. So permissions that I have now, if I switch a role, I will not have them anymore. Yeah, so that could be a restriction, that could be a constraint that could be put on there, if there is a reason for that. Cardinality can say something about the maximum number of users that have a particular role. You don't want all of the users in an organization to have the same to be able to act in the director role. There'll be two, maybe three people that are in that particular role. Yeah, the director itself, maybe some deputies in case they need to take over when the director is not available. So you can set constraints there also. Prerequisite roles means that I can be in a role only if I have another role also. We'll go back here. There. I could be in this role only if I would have access to this role also. Yeah? So you could have some constraints there. I can be in I can't be in this role if I'm not in this role, for example. So that the project lead will always. If he's in that role, he also needs to have the role of the production engineer. So I can put constraints on that. Other way. There. And then obviously the if I combine hierarchy and constraints, I get to the let's say the complete model, the most complete model. Okay, so that was discretionary and role-based access control. Then the next step will be the attribute-based access control. What we do there is that we have particular characteristics of a subject or an object. Now we'll put some characteristics on them, and then based on these characteristics, based on these attributes, we can define the access. So the attribute, I'll have to go a bit far, sorry for that. But the attributes are just some characteristics that define a particular subject or object, as a name and a value, of course. Can be at subject level. So at subject level, it could be a name, an organization, a job, or whatever. At an object level, object attributes could include date, subject, author, whatever you want, file name. Besides subjects and object attributes, there are also so-called environmental attributes. Could, for example, be the day and the time. I can access this file during office hours. Yeah, that during office hours, that was not possible in any of the other two models. But in ABAC, it is possible because we have these environmental attribute also. On network security, I can access this file if I am on this particular network. And so if I'm on my home network, I can't access documents here at this school network. ABAC is a logical access control. So whenever somebody wants access, I think this is more or less clear. Whenever somebody wants access, a subject wants to access an object, we'll look at the attributes, we look at the environment, and we'll look at the rules that are connecting all of those. And so we get this so-called logical architecture. We have a user who wants to access an object. And so when he wants that, there is the attributes of the subject and of the object and the environment. And then there is the access policy control that describes what kind of combinations are allowed to have access. So all of that information is combined and then decided if indeed access can be given. So the first step is that there is a request from the user to access an object, and then the access control mechanism here in the middle will access all of these to see what the current situation is. Okay, we have this user, what are his attributes or her attributes? He wants to access this particular object, what are the attributes of this object? What are the attributes of the environment? And then look at the policy, the access control policy, to see if access is possible or not, access is allowed or not. And then obviously, access is granted or denied. Just very shortly, we had the access control list in the discretionary access model, and access ABAC attribute-based access control is way more complicated. Here we see how a subject can get access to an object in ACL. It's pretty complex already, but once we look at ABAC, it gets more complicated because we have to look at rules, we have to look at the attributes of the subject and the object. Now all of that has to be taken into account. ABAC has a number of policies that is a set of rules and relationships that show what is allowable and what is not allowable based on the attributes of subjects and objects in the environment. And so this is more or less describing what is allowed and what is not allowed in a particular situation. It's based on privileges of subjects. Privileges of subjects just means what is a subject allowed to do. And what is a subject allowed to do, that is something that is defined not by the user itself, obviously, but by some kind of authority. And that is in the policy. Again, that could be also role-based. Yeah, so a user has a particular role, and based on that role, the authority will define a number of privileges for that user. Could also be subject-based only. And these policies, they are written from the perspective of protecting the object. Let's try to formalize it a bit more, these policies. We have a set of subjects, objects, and the environment. And each of these subjects, objects, and environments can have attributes. So the attributes of a specific object are taken from the, sorry, of the specific subject are taken from the set of all possible attributes of subjects. Now, so SA is the set of all attributes that we can add to a subject, similar for objects and an environment. Then we have the attributes of a specific subject. So when I talk about all subjects, I use capital S. When I talk about the specific one, I use the small s. So if I have a specific subject, I can look at the attributes that that specific subject has. It's similar again, objects and environment. And then the policy is just some kind of Boolean function that takes into account the attributes of the specific subject, of the specific object that the subject wants to access, and the environment. And so we can give access to the subject, from the subject to the object in this environment, if this Boolean function will come back with true. Yeah, so that function will just return true or false. You can get access or not. And that function is more or less related to the policy base, of course. Just as a simple example to make it more tangible, we have movies, R-rated movies, PG-13, and G-rated movies. R-rated movies means simply 17 and older, then you can watch them. G is for any age, and then PG-13 is an intermediate category, which means you have to be at least 13-year-old. So let's see how access control of people, of users, to movies would be arranged in role-based access control. Well, first of all, each user should have a role, and a role would be here. I gave them names: adult, juvenile, or child. So an adult is a person that is 17 or over. A juvenile is a person between 13 and 17, and a child is a person below 13. And so each user will be assigned a single role. Then there are three permissions: can view R-rated, can view PG-13, and can view G-rated movies. And then the access control rules are: an adult role gets assigned all three permissions. The juvenile will get just two permissions. He will not get the permission to rate view R-rated movies. The child will only get a single permission: can view G. That's all. Yeah, so once we have this in place, if a person comes and says, hey, I am in a juvenile role and I want to see this R-rated movie, we can see, okay, juvenile role, two permissions. Oh, no, you can't see that because you don't have that permission. If an adult comes and he wants to see a G-rated movie, yeah, let's see, adult role, you get all these three permissions. Can view G is in there, so you can watch that. Assigning a user to a specific role or a permission to a specific role, these are manual things. There is an administrator that should see a person and then say, okay, I see you're an adult, I see your passport, I will assign to you the role of adult. How does it work in attribute-based access control? First of all, there is no need to define roles. Users and objects have attributes, properties, so to say. Yeah? So age is a property of a subject, of a user. Rating is a property of a movie, in this case, so of an object. We're not using environment for now. So here's one rule that is more than enough. a user, if I have a user and a particular movie, yeah, the user has a property, it's age, an attribute, it's age. The movie has an attribute, the rating, and I'll just check if the age of the user is over 17 and the rating is any of these three, or the user is over 13 but under 17 and the rating is anything except R, or if the age is low, it's below 13 and the rating is only G, then I get access. So one single rule, which was the same as assigning all the roles and all the permissions, etc., in the old system. Yeah, so one simple rule. Whenever we have a user, we assign him some attributes, age in this case, and whenever we have a movie, we assign that one movie a particular rating, and then everything is taken care of. If you want more properties, if you want, for example, different kind of memberships of this for this particular online entertainment store, maybe you have a premium membership and a regular membership. Again, if I subscribe to this store, I'm a user, I get assigned some attributes. One of these attributes was the age. Another attribute could be my type of subscription. So type of membership type is a property of the user. And so based on my membership type, I could also see particular movies or maybe not or whatever. Yeah. So if I am a regular subscriber, I can only see old releases. If I'm a premium subscriber, I can see anything. And so we can combine these two rules, this one and this one, that I get access if I'm looking at the correct rated movie, and if I have the correct membership, then I can get access. So that's the last rule. Yeah, both should be satisfied. Clear? Let me see. I have a number of slides extra. Where are we? But I have to go and skip a bit because of time constraints. Let me see. Yeah, let me just the information is anyway in the book. Let me go and stress a number of things that I think is important that I should stress. Where is it? There. Here you see the management of credentials. There is, for example, production of a credential. Credential could be a smart card or whatever, right? There has to be a user has a role and it should be produced. But what I want to say is something about that last bit that is often forgotten. The last phase here in this CM module is more or less related to the ending of a credential. Yeah, so it's always when we talk about certificates or smart cards. There is always a lot of focus on making sure that you get the correct credentials on your smart card, etc. But what if the lifetime of that smart card has ended, of the credential is withdrawn? You need to think about also revocation of a smart card, about maybe destruction of a smart card, resetting a PIN, all these kinds of things. So a life cycle of any object in general also include that last phase where credentials are in this case revoked. Okay. Let me say a last few words about the trust framework. This is traditional. A user wants to get access to some kind of information from this relaying party, and for that to do that, he actually has an agreement with an identity service provider, and so he identifies to that service provider. The service provider checks the identity. He can vouch for this particular person. He makes an electronic identity of that person. And then once the user wants to access information here, then this party can access the identity service provider to get confirmation about the identity of the particular user. Unfortunately, there is no or little standard in this particular picture. So anybody can do whatever they want, and the relying party should be able to interoperate with a lot of different kind of standards. Not standards, a lot of different formats. So that's not good. So there is a so-called Open Identity Trust Framework. There is a lot of abbreviations. I will leave that to you to read in the book. But the new structure looks like this. There might be a number of identity providers, and there might be a number of relaying parties. But because we have this standard format in the middle, it's much easier for them to communicate and to have trust in what the other party is doing. Yeah, so if all parties stick to this particular standard, then checking the identity, the relying party checking the identity of the user is a much easier task. That was very quick at the end. Sorry for that. The case study, again, that is something that you could anyway read in the book. Any questions so far? Okay. The question is RBAC a role can be executed by a number of users? What I mean there is that let's have an example. The secretaries here. Yeah, there is a number of secretaries within a company, and all of those will have similar access rights, or maybe even the same access right. But you can deviate a bit. If they have the same access right, then all of these 10 persons that are in a secretary position, they will be able to have this role of secretary. Yeah. In this particular picture, I can go here. Yeah. So here is this role is the same. It's a production engineer, right? And that could be different person. That doesn't even need to be a single person in this particular case. There could be three production engineers in this project. But because their responsibility within the process and within the project is the same, they have the same access rights. Yeah. Other questions? I wouldn't say that ABAC is a simplification of RBAC. I would say that it is more a complication. But you could... It's not so much simplifying the model, but you could... Suppose that there are three persons having this role here, right? It could be that they still have some different responsibilities within the project. And so using attributes, I could make sure that they get slightly different access control. So the majority of the access is based on the role, but because you are working in working package 1 and you are working in working package 2, I can be able, by that attribute, I can give you different access rights. Yeah, because you are looking at documents or you're manipulating documents that he doesn't need access to, or maybe not the same kind of access. So you can... What's the English word? You can have the granularity can be better in ABAC than in RBAC. Yeah? Was that clear? Okay, good. Other questions? Okay, if not, then let's have a short break and then we'll continue at 12:20. For jeg skal hente nye batterier. Jeg stoler ikke på dette. Okay, okay. Okay, let's quickly continue with the mandatory access control models. Oh, that's not the good button. This is. I will start with information on the Bell-LaPadula model, and then say something about other models too, and then the rest. As far as we manage. Start with that one, yeah. Let's start with stating two facts. And please tell me if you disagree with these facts or not. All complex security software systems have eventually revealed flaws or bugs that needed to be fixed. Does anybody disagree? I think we can't disagree with that. That's just experience. And it's extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, to build a computer system that is not vulnerable to a variety of security attacks. Do you agree or disagree? You can disagree. You can build it. You can make it more secure. You can't make it secure, unfortunately. If I have my mobile phone, there is information on this, and I put it in concrete and drop it in the ocean, it's secure and completely unusable. Yeah, so usability is also an issue. Yeah, it should be a usable system, but because it's a complex system, it's often very difficult to make it secure, if not impossible. Problems is both in designing such a system and in implementing that particular design. It's difficult to design so that the intended level of security is actually reached. So there is a lot of securities, there is a lot of vulnerabilities known and unknown out there that we have to take into account. But even if we could design this perfect system, then it is still a matter of implementing that. And implementation also gives a lot of errors. So would be great if we could mathematically prove that a system is secure, right? Because then there is no, then we are certain, of course. So with that in mind, some formal models of computer security have been made. And they are used to verify security design and the implementation. Both, of course. It started all by, it was initiated by the U.S. Department of Defense, as great research. The most influential model is the Bella Padula from the early 70s, first half of the 70s. So we'll discuss that first, but we'll have some more models after that. In this model, Bella Padula, we will have a number of we have subjects and objects again, and each of them will be assigned security classes. Remember, this is mandatory access control. What we said in the previous slide said that is based on security classes. These security classes follow some kind of strict hierarchy. So, for example, in military, you always see these kinds of classifications. So, top secret, which is a higher classification than secret, and then confidential, restricted, and unclassified. Unclassified is a classification, by the way. It's not a lack of classification, it is a classification. So you can see a stamp on a document saying unclassified. So that's more military. In terms of commercial companies, you might have something like strategic information, which has a higher level of security than sensitive information, and confidential and public information at the other end. So both subjects and objects will get such a label, and when we have a label, a security label for a subject, we will call it a security clearance. When you have a security label for an object, we call it a security classification. So if I have a document, I can look at that document and I say, I classify this document as confidential. And when I have a person, I can look at that person, I can do some background checking on that person, and I can give him a security clearance up to secret. With all this, we have what is called a multi-level security. So there are different levels, multiple levels of security classes in such a model. And we have to be careful that subjects at a higher level of classification do not reveal information to subjects at a lower level of clearance, I should say. The subject has a security clearance. So if your clearance is secret, and his clearance is confidential, you cannot share information with him. If we read this, even if the information is confidential classified, you should not be able to share it with him. That's what that rule says. Let's look at the model. The model defines four access modes. Read, so I can see a document, I can read it. Append, which is what we call in normal terminology write of an object. So I could, for example, write information into a database or something like that. What they call write is actually the combination of those two, read and write. So the terminology is a bit strange at least, but that's so be it. Yeah, so when we talk about append, we are just entering information, but we're not able, once we have entered the information, we know, of course, what we entered, but we are not able to see it anymore. When you have write access, you can write it, and then you can see it also. And then execute, which doesn't have anything to do with read or write, but just execution of an object. If we have a multi-level secure system, we have to make sure that it is indeed secure, and we can do that by a number of enforced rules. First rule is no read-up, which we also refer to as the simple security property. I will get back to these in a second. No write-down. No read-up means that I can't read information from a higher level of no object with a higher level of classification, security classification. No write-down means that I can't write it to, I can't write secret information into a confidential document. Sounds logical, right? It's called the star property. Why is it called the star property? Any ideas? Well, actually, when they were writing this model, when they were writing the paper about it, they had a name for this no read-up. They call that the simple security property. And they had not figured out the name for this property. So they had just a placeholder, star. And then when they sent it in, it was still star. They hadn't come up with it with a name. And so from then on, it was the star property. Both of these, in principle, make sure that there is mandatory access control. Now these two properties take care of that. And then there is a third property called the DS property that you can grant access to other individuals. Yeah, as long as these two are still satisfied. Yeah? I can't give access to a top secret document to a person with a confidential clearance. What does it mean, no write-down, so the star property? Suppose that this person has access to, let's say, a secret document and a confidential document. Yeah. Once he accesses this document, once he can read from this document, his security clearance should at least be secret also, at least as high as this particular object. Yeah. When he has a secret clearance, and he wants to write information to a confidential document, that is prohibited. That's forbidden. Why? Because otherwise he could take secret information and copy it into a confidential document, and then somebody else with confidential clearance could just access that secret information. So that's why we don't allow to write information to a document of a lower classification than the classification of the subject. Okay, a bit more formal description. If we have a system, the state of a system is defined by these four sets, B, M, F, and H. So B is the current access state. B is a set of a number of these triples, a subject, an object, and access control, access right. Yeah, and that's what people want at that point in time. So a subject, S, is trying to access an object O with this particular access right. Doesn't mean that it's allowed, but it's just what is wanted. The access matrix, we talked about that the last hour. The access matrix shows what is allowed. So a subject S and an object O can be accessed in the way that is described in this access matrix. Then we have three level functions. Classification of objects. So when I have an object, I can get the classification of that object through this function. When I have a subject, I can get the clearance level of that subject. But on top of that, I can also have the current security level. So somebody who has a top secret clearance level could, at this point in time, be authorized for confidential information. That point in time, he can't read the top secret information anymore, but he can read other information. And then there, the last one is the hierarchy. And the hierarchy is a rooted tree of the objects in the system. And then the Bell-LaPadula model requires that the security level of an object must dominate the security level of its parent. And that goes all the way down, obviously. So what if we look at these properties? So first, the simple security property. What was that? No read up. Let's call that. No read up, yeah. No write down or no read up. So what does it mean? If a subject wants to read a particular object, we have to check if the clearance level of that subject, the current clearance level of that subject, is at least as high as the classification of the object. So when I'm one, my current security, my current clearance level is secret, I can read a confidential document. When my current level is confidential, I can't read a secret document. I can only read what, yeah, up to my level of clearance. The star property, that's no write down. So if I want to, there is a difference between append and write in this case. If I want to append, so what we call write in normal terminology, when I just want to add information to a document, my confidentiality level should be at most one of the objects. So I can't take secret information. Let's suppose that my level is secret. I can't write that to a confidential file. That's what I want to say. That's what we just had in the drawing. If we want to have write access, this write access, as they define it, is read and write access, then both properties should hold. So then there should be equality in the clearance level and the classification level. That's clear. And then the DS property also. I'll leave that for you to. So what now makes a secure system? Well, as said, the access state, the current access state, that is what people want to do. I want to access a particular file with a particular classification, and the system will give me access or not. The state of a system is secure if for all of these access controls that users want, that all of those are allowed according to the three properties that we saw before, SS, star, and DS. Yeah, if all of those are satisfied for all these current access, for all these elements of B, then we are in a secure state. Everybody is doing as they should do. But the security state of a system will change if anything happens to any of these four components. Yeah, so if there is a new access request, yeah, the security state changes. We are secure, but something changes and we have to reevaluate. But as long as any state change in any of these components, not just a new access, but in any of these four components, if that will result again in something that will not violate the three previously stated properties, then I still am in I still remain in a secure state. So here are some rules that you can do in this model. You could get access to a document, or you could release access to a document. That will actually change the content of this set B. You can change the access matrix M. You can look at the F function. You can change something there, or you can actually change if you create a new object, then that the hierarchy will change, or if you delete an object or whatever. So any of these changes in B, M, F, or H, will define a new state, and then the security has to be evaluated again if all of the elements of B satisfy the three properties. Let's have a look at an example. We have a student, Carla, and we have a teacher. His name is not there. The student has a student role for this particular class, and the teacher has a teaching role which is higher than the student role, but he also has the student role. So let me see here. What do we have here? In this student role, you can have read and write access, and in the teacher role, you can have read and write access for the teacher and for the student. Then, if somebody can write as in the student role, they can also write in the teacher role. Not the other way around, no write down, star property. And if they have read access at the teacher role, they can also read something at the at this level. Not the other way around again, no read up. So the arrows indicate here no read down and no write up. Sorry, the other way around, no read down, no write up. Whatever, doesn't matter. You know what I mean. So suppose that there is a file F1 that is created by the teacher, and there is a file F2 which is created by the student. And this is maybe the answer to some kind of assignment, and then the teacher has to read that. Teacher has also this role, so he can read that particular file, but he wants to give comments on it. And so he has to create a file, he has to write a file with the comments to this particular delivery of the student. So he will create a file F3, but that file should be readable by the student, obviously, otherwise it doesn't make any sense. So this file should be created in the student role. Yeah? And so once the teacher has done that, the student can read it. That's very simple. That's still very simple. Now assume that the teacher wants to make an exam. So he has a template for the exam made in the under the teacher role. So that's here. It's a template. And so he can read that, and he can make changes to that, and he can create a new file from that, the actual exam. But because this is made under this role, this F4 is also classified under this security level. Yeah, and now he made an exam that he can see, he can read and write in that, but none of the students can, because the classification is teacher here, while the classification of the student is just student, and they don't get to read that information. So there should be some offline channel where actually this document is declassified. Teacher can't do that. There should be an administrative role that takes this teacher level document and declassifies it to student level. Once that is done, then the student can read it. Okay, the student can read it. She can make her exam in this case. And she has the answers to the exam. Where is that? Oh, here. She actually classified that at the teacher level. Why? If she classified that at the student level, everybody could see her answers. That's not the case. That should not be. So the student should make an exam, and the answers to the exam should be at the teacher level classification. That's possible, because we can have write up. The funny thing is now, this is her exam. She knows what she wrote. But once she actually saves this file here, she has no access to it anymore. She can create it, she can write it, and then she can't read it anymore. Because now this is teacher level classified, while her highest classification is student, she doesn't have access anymore. Clear? Sorry about the confusion about up and down and read and write. Just look at the arrows. No write down, no read up. Yeah. That would be a nice exam question. For confusion. Okay, anyway. So that's the Bella Padula model. Is that clear? Was that... okay, good. There are other models also. So this is not the only model. So the Bella Padula model was a model for confidentiality. There are other models that provide integrity but not confidentiality. And actually, there is also one model that we'll have in a few minutes that will provide both of that. The BIBA is another model which provides integrity. It's very similar to the Bella Padula model. You can do a few things. Again, you have access modes. We have modify, which is similar to the write and the update information from the Bella Padula model. Observe, which is read, execute, and then invocus is something new. But if you see the rules that they have, we have, instead of simple security, we have simple integrity. We have, this is related to the star property and the DS property. So all of that is more or less the same. So I will not pay a lot of attention to that. Another model is the Clark-Wilson integrity model. Again, focusing on the integrity and not so much confidentiality. It's also more for commercial applications. Bella Padula was more for military information. The two concepts that I have, will from form transactions and separation of duty amongst users. So will form transactions means that the way that users can manipulate data is constrained. And it's constrained such that integrity is preserved all of the time. And separation of duty means that if I'm allowed to do one task, I'm not allowed to do other tasks. There's some components in there. Constrained and unconstrained data items. That has to do with the transactions. And integrity verification procedures and transformation procedures. I will not say too much about it. Let me see. Here we have an example. What you will see in here is certification rules and where are they? The enforcement rules. So these govern what can be done with documents to preserve integrity. We'll not go into details here either. I want to say a bit more about the Chinese wall model. So what is the Chinese wall model? That actually says that once I have accessed a particular object, I am restricted in what other objects I can access. Here's an example. They use conflict of interest clauses, and then within a conflict of interest clause there are a number of data sets, and then each data set contains a number of objects. A conflict of interest clause means that here we see two banking organizations. Yeah, if I get access to information of one banking organization, yeah, that could lead to a conflict when I get access to another. Yeah, so a number of organizations that are within one conflict of interest clause. Yeah, that means that if I get access to document A, I can't get access to information from bank B anymore. Yeah. Here is another company, Gas A. Yeah, if I get access here, that has nothing to do with this company. So there is no conflict of interest. Yeah, and I can still access this information. Yeah, and the same with the oil companies. Yeah. So I group together companies that more or less I can just pick one company and access the data of that company and not the others within that group. Within another class, I can access information. So more or less if I access information, for example, here, document A, B, or C, then there is built a wall around this part of the conflict, or around the rest of the company's data sets in that conflict of interest domain class, that I don't have access anymore. Yeah, I access something, and then I build a wall, a Chinese wall around the rest, and that's forbidden territory. So here's the simple security rule. A subject can access an object only if it's in the same data set that I already accessed. Yeah. Suppose I already access A, then I can access B because it's in the same data set. That's one way. Or I have not accessed any documents in that conflict of interest clause anyway. So all of the data sets in there are not touched by me. But once I touch within a conflict of interest clause, within one of the data sets in there, I access one of the objects, then I have a lot of restrictions there. So that's a simple security rule, or the analog of that. And then the style property about writing. I can write an object. So subject S can write an object O only if I can read according to the I can read it according to the previous rule, or and all of the objects that I can read are within the same domain, within the same data set. We're going back here. If I'm only accessing this information, I can write. Once I've accessed information here and information here, I've accessed information from different data sets, then I can't write anymore. Because that's forbidden than this. I've accessed to what was it, object A and object F, I think it was. Those are in different data sets, so I can't write anymore. Why is that? Suppose that we have two subjects, and the first subject has access to this data set, so these objects and here also, and the other one has access here to the same bank information, but to Oil B company, the data set of Oil B company. Suppose that this user would start writing this this object. There is no restriction here on where he can write it. He could write it here, so there's a G here, not an A anymore. So once he would do that, all of a sudden, this particular user or this particular subject would get access to that document also, which is not allowed because of this conflict of interest domain. Yeah, so that's why it's not allowed. Could be very strict. Probably it's very strict, but at least that's the rules, as I said. So with this style property, that is prohibited. Okay, that's the Chinese wall model, and then some other models that we have now. Let's have a look at... Oh, time is really running thin. Let's have a look at the concept of trusted systems. We'll start there. So this is what we all the time have been talking about. We have a number of subjects who want access to a number of objects. And there is some security regulations that govern how that is done, how the access is granted. Could be any model. Doesn't need to be mandatory access control. Can be anything. But anyway, there is a reference monitor that can check the required access against the database and then give access or deny it. Yeah, and everything that is happening is actually also sent to some kind of audit file such that it can be investigated. So in here will be also this store property, and we'll see how that works now. This is without anything, right? We have a user who can access some kind of data file, and he has read and write access to that, and then Alice comes and she makes some bogus file. For which she has read and write access, but she gives Bob also write access. And actually, she is interested in some information in this data file, and she wants to read that, but she can't read it. She doesn't have access to this file. But if for some magical reason this information could appear here, all of a sudden she could read it. That would be great. So what she does is some kind of Trojan horse is used, which uses Bob's access to access this file, get that information, and then write it in here, because Bob can write in there. Yeah? And then once that information is in there, Alice can see it. So how does it work once we have the reference monitor in place? So, in principle, the beginning is all the same. So we have different classifications level. This is a higher level than this, but the remainder of the setup is the same. But we have the reference monitor checking all the things that are going on. So now the Trojan horse again tries to has Bob's classification level, so it's possible to read information from this file, so the Trojan horse can get access to this information. And then once he wants to write it to a file that Alice can read, then there is a problem, because this is of a lower classification level, and this information is from a higher level, and so that's prohibited by the star property. No write down. And so here the reference monitor will stop, in this case the Trojan horse, or Bob even. Even Bob can't do it himself, to write that information in this file. Yeah? Okay, so that's very quickly something about the concept of trusted systems. Again, there is an application of multi-level security that I will skip. And let me see what is most interesting to talk about. I guess I will leave the common criteria and the related assurance and evaluation to yourself to read. The slides will be are anyway in Blackboard, so you can see that. And I will spend the last few minutes before the recording stops to say something about trusted computing. Yeah, that should be possible. Okay, very quickly, trusted platform module, which is used is a chip that's used at the heart of a trusted computing approach. And the trusted computing provides actually three services: authenticated boot, certification, and encryption. Authenticated boot, if we look at a typical boot process in a nutshell, what happens is that a piece of code is loaded and executed, and then that piece of code will load the next block of the boot. Yeah, and so that will execute it again, and then that will load some new data, etc., etc. So that is a process that will continue until the full boot process has finished. If we look at trusted computing, then every time that such a block is loaded, before it's executed, actually the trusted computing hardware will check the validity of that part that is just loaded. So if somebody changes part of the boot sector, that will be detected here. There will be a log file of what's happening also, and again that should be some tamper resistant log, not that I tamper with the boot process, but then in order to be invisible I change the log. So everything that is happening with the boot should be logged in a tamper resistant log. What I do with the boot process, I can also later on do with additional processes of loading software or hardware. But anyway, at the very end, I know that this boot has been done in the correct way. Yeah, every time that new blocks were read, there was a verification of the correctness of that. So in the end, I will end up with a state of the hardware and software that should be trusted. It's a well-defined state. So that's the authenticated boot. If we talk about certification, the trusted platform module can certify configurations to other parties by using digital signatures. So that's relates again to what we had in crypto. By using signatures, by using certificates, we can make sure that everything is as it should be, that there are no intentional or unintentional changes to the to any state. And why can we have that? Because at the very end, we trust the trusted platform module, which you can see if you're talking in terms of certificates. We can see that as a root of the public key infrastructure. Yeah. So because the trusted platform module is doing all of this, we trust that, and the TPM is the only one that possesses the private key to do the signing of the configurations. In this process, there's one more thing. We can use, if we access information, we can actually use random nonces, so random values, to check if the result that we get back from the trusted platform module is fresh. Not that I just access a file, and then because even though something has changed, there is something that is preventing me to read the TPM, and it sends back a previous result. Yeah, by including the random value, I assure that the checking can only be done by the trusted platform module. Something about encryption. Encryption is done with symmetric algorithms, and for symmetric algorithms we need a key, and actually that key is derived from a master key. That's not on this. It's derived from a master key there, which resides inside the trusted platform module and the current configuration. Yeah, so the key that is used for encryption is derived from those two parts. Meaning that if I change my configuration, then the key that is derived from that new configuration and the master key is all of a sudden different. And so decryption is no longer possible. Yeah, so we can only decrypt once the configuration is the same. Very briefly, the looks of a trusted platform module. All of the calculations are done inside this module that is tamper resistant, of course. Yeah, so I can't influence any of these processes. What I see, what I send in, or what I get out, that's the only thing. I don't have any influence of what's going on inside this module. All of the cryptographic and other operations are going inside. So key generation, random number generation, I'm not sure if the master key is not mentioned here. I guess it's part of this one. The cryptographic process, all of that is taking place inside the trusted platform module. And making sure that it is indeed a secure system. Nobody can tamper with that. As a last slide then, I just want to show this one, how it works for an encrypted file. In our storage, we have an encrypted file, and attached to that encrypted file is the protected symmetric key. So we're using symmetric crypto, I said. If I want to access this particular file, if I have right to access that particular file, the protected symmetric key, the encrypted symmetric key, is actually sent to the TPM, and then in the TPM there is a verification done. Is the configuration correct? What happens is that from the master key and the configuration, the key is derived, and then it's checked if that is correct key. And once it is, the symmetric key is decrypted, and then that is used in the in the user application to perform the decryption of this particular file. And then the decrypted file, the plain text file, is available to the user. Yeah? But the checking of this key, if this is correct key, and if the configuration is correct, that is done by the trusted platform model TPM. Okay, we are a bit over time already, so I would like to stop here and leave common criteria and what was it, evaluation and assurance and evaluation to yourself. Any questions so far? Okay, good. So today we had a number of access control models, four different types of access control models. Okay, good. Last thing that I wanted to say, the current assignment is due, I think, next Wednesday. Is it? Yeah, I think so. The last assignment I will give out on the day after, so the lecture we have in a week from now. Again, that one will have a 3-week delivery period also. Yeah, that will be on system security. So, sorry? What do you want? Okay, sorry. The people online don't know what you ask for, so they just still don't know. No, it will be a theoretical one also. Yeah, most likely. I have an idea, but I haven't really filled in the details yet. Okay, good. Well then, thank you for your attention.